Never seen such a consistent level of enthusiasm from a teacher, or anyone else for that matter. This man has a passion for teaching. He is a larger-than-life, superhuman mix of educator, psychologist, historian, magician, stand-up comic, and certified lunatic. Some days I feel I should have to pay admission to see his lesson, and every day I'm amazed that I've learned so much. I only hope to find something to do with my life that brings me that much joy and fulfillment. One thing is certain. Learning history has never been this much fun or this easy. I don't mean easy as in we don't have to learn a lot. I mean easy as in I noticed that I'm retaining all of the content without my usual struggles. It must be that brain-based research and those mnemonics that Mr. Burgess told us about at the beginning of the year. I have even noticed that some of my friends, who always seem to fail the classes that we have together, understand the material. It's really strange. These are the same kids that are getting in trouble and having confrontations with teachers in my other classes, and yet here they thrive. It's almost like the air is easier to breathe in SS9. I'm going to be honest with you. Some days, this class is the only reason I come to school. End quotes. The world's greatest GPS. Your brain. I found this letter writing exercise to be extremely valuable, and it's something I recommend you consider trying for yourself. It allowed me to construct a vision of what I want students to experience in my class. It serves as the ideal goal that I'm shooting for as I proceed through my career. When I lack motivation or inspiration, I reread this passage and rededicate myself to fulfilling the vision. When embarking on any journey, choosing the destination is a critical first step. With a destination in mind, you can set your internal GPS and be assured you are heading in the correct direction. It makes no sense at all to drive the streets of your city, getting further and further lost and increasingly frustrated, and then have the nerve to blame your expensive GPS system when, actually, you never entered a destination. You have to have a vision of what your ideal classroom experience looks like if you want to have any hope of creating it. In addition to a specific destination, you must also have an accurate view of the current reality of your class. A GPS doesn't work unless the system can determine your precise current location and its maps are up to date. When you have a realistic view of your current classroom and can see where it falls short of your ultimate vision, you have something to work with. In his wonderful book, Creating, Robert Fritz describes how this gap between current reality and vision creates a certain tension. If you are truly committed to fulfilling your vision, this tension will drive you to constantly work to close the gap. Knowing that you aren't living up to the standard you've set for yourself feels uncomfortable. Therefore, it is extremely motivating and rewarding to move towards resolving this dissonance. Two questions for raising the bar. I often ask my seminar participants to consider their answers to the following two questions. For many, acknowledging the truth is somewhat painful. I hope you'll take a few minutes to answer these questions for yourself. The purpose here is to get you to consider your expectations and standards for what is possible in a classroom. Question 1. If your students didn't have to be there, would you be teaching to an empty room? In other words, if, like some college courses, there were no attendance requirements and no consequences for missing class, and your students were only held responsible for passing the tests, would they still show up every day for your class? Is there something about you and the experience of being a part of your class that would draw students in? Have you created an environment that is so unique and so enjoyable that students are pulled into your room as if by a magnet? Is your class so engaging that students would show up on a Saturday if you invited them to come in for a special lesson opportunity? Are students rescheduling doctor appointments and trips off campus to avoid missing your class? Do they make their parents bring them back after appointments in the hopes of still catching your period? Do students wait to go to the bathroom until their next period because they are afraid they'll miss something unforgettable in your room? Do you have students trying to ditch their other periods because they want to be a part of your lesson more than once? Do they try to bring their friends into your class so that they can have the experience? Will they create havoc in the counseling office if they get their schedule changed and moved to another teacher, even though that teacher might be awesome as well? Do they try to sneak back on campus after graduation in order to participate in certain lessons again? Do they talk about things that happened in your class years afterward? When you see them the next year, do they sincerely express how much they miss your class? Question 2. Do you have any lessons you could sell tickets for? Wow. Now that is really raising the bar. I'll honestly tell you that I don't have a lot of those, but I do have some. The lunar landing lesson for sure. Maybe the 60s party, the speakeasy, and the day the Red Scare supervillain comes to school. Probably the Salem witchcraft trials, the Trail of Tears, and the day the Tin Man teaches the Bill of Rights. I sincerely believe there are days I could have a cash register outside of the door and students would pay a small sum of money to come in. I'm trying to create as many of those days as I possibly can and sprinkle them throughout the school year. I don't really expect teachers to be able to answer yes to both questions, especially the second, for every one of their lessons. But I do want them, and you, to use these questions to create a bar-raising paradigm shift. So how is it possible to transform your class to the point where you can answer yes to the preceding questions? One way I try to do it is by attempting to blur the lines between education and entertainment. I stopped using the term edutainment because it became a bit of a cliche, but I still believe it is a fairly accurate term for my classroom. My goal is to, at least sometimes, have students asking themselves, is this a lesson I walked into or is it a show? When I'm presenting content, I attempt to draw on tried and true principles of staging and showmanship in order to turn my lesson into an event, an extravaganza. In section 2 of this book, I provide great detail on how to incorporate naturally engaging elements into your class on a daily basis and provide sound reasoning why entertainment and fun can and should go hand in hand with learning. The goal is to transform your class into something irresistible to your students. Positioning and reframing. Proper positioning is one of the key techniques needed to effectively transform your class into a powerful must-be place. Positioning is a marketing term that was made famous by Al Reese and Jack Trout in their groundbreaking book, Positioning, The Battle for Your Mind. It is the process by which you create a compelling picture and understanding in the minds of your audience members to differentiate your brand, product, or service. For example, Walmart is positioned as the place to go for huge selection and low prices. On the other hand, Nordstrom is positioned as a place for high-end shopping and extraordinary customer service. Zappos built a business by using legendary, remarkable customer service to generate word-of-mouth referrals and loyal customers. Prius is positioned as the green alternative for those who are environmentally conscious. You can send a package with any number of services, but where would you go if it absolutely, positively had to be there overnight? Federal Express built a business by positioning itself through speed of delivery. I've heard the direct marketing genius Dan Kennedy speak about the USP, unique selling proposition, of Domino's Pizza many times. The original positioning statement was, fresh, hot pizza delivered in 30 minutes or less, guaranteed. By positioning themselves this way, they literally created a category that didn't exist and dominated it for a long time. They didn't say they had the best pizza, but if you were a starving college student who wanted a pizza fast, you knew exactly who to call. I think you get the idea. So what does positioning have to do with teaching? Well, again, I turn to a question I learned from Dan Kennedy's magnetic marketing program. It's a question marketers must answer for potential clients. Why should I do business with you? Out of all of the possible choices in your category. To succeed in business, you must position yourself in the marketplace so you are the clear choice amongst all alternatives and against the alternative of doing nothing at all. This is exactly what we must do as teachers as well. Why should our students bother to learn what we are teaching? Why should they bother to give us their attention and active engagement in the first place? Because here's the truth. Not only are we fighting to stand out from all of the images, sounds, products, people, and emotions vying for their attention, we are also fighting to keep them from tuning out altogether. It isn't easy. There's a lot of noise out there, and let's face it, it's hard for our subjects to compete with the excitement of their favorite reality show or real-life drama in the halls. It's easy to see why so many teachers use what I call the medicine approach. They say, I know this stuff is hard, but you have to bear with me and hang in there because it's on the test. I know this is rough going and not exactly fun, but if you don't learn this stuff, you can't be successful at the next level. Talk about piss poor motivation. Suffer through this grueling ordeal so that you can answer a few more questions right on the state test. They are positioning their lesson like it's a bitter medicine that must be swallowed in order to get better. Don't position your material as if it's an awful tasting medicine. Position your content as if it's amazing. Give motivating reasons why the material is important to know. Because it's on the test doesn't cut it. If you can't explain why someone should pay attention to what you're saying, maybe you shouldn't be saying it. I go out of my way to position my class as an amazing and extraordinarily unique place filled with outrageously engaging content and activities. I position it as a place that provides opportunities for creative expression. I also try to position each lesson so students can personalize the material and apply it to their world. I add in the LCLs, life-changing lessons, in an attempt to make my class fulfilling and meaningful. Then, when appropriate, I add in the entertainment and fun factor to top it all off. I design my lessons so that even the tough material goes down easy, much like the pet owner who hides the pill inside of a tasty morsel. And I don't apologize for utilizing all of the tricks of the trade to accomplish my goals. Sometimes we need to change our students' perceptions of the material we're teaching. The way to do this is called reframing. Reframing involves providing a new context for the material that helps to break down the negative associations many students come into class with. I'm sure you've heard students saying things like, "I hate math. History is boring. I can't write. I'll never need to know this in real life." These are some of the preconceived notions our students bring with them to school. Our job is to create a mental paradigm shift by reframing the content and its value and relevancy to their lives. The truth is, students probably don't really hate math. They hate the way it's been taught to them in the past. They hate the fact that they have struggled to learn math in the past. They think history is boring because the teacher somewhere along the way killed it with dreary bookwork, worksheets, and monotonous lectures. History isn't boring. Their history class was. When students can't see any real-world connection or value to a particular subject, they question whether it's worth the investment and effort. And rightly so. As adults, we don't like to feel that our time and efforts are being wasted. Students are no different. The following story is my favorite example of the power of reframing. When my son was about 5 or 6 years old, I took him to a pizza place with two other families. It was one of those places with a small game area for children. This one also had about 5 of those gumball-type vending machines that spit out prizes, stickers, small toys, temporary tattoos, etc., rather than gum. My son Hayden and two of his buddies approached the machines excitedly with quarters in hand. The first friend put his money in and got a small plastic glow-in-the-dark T-Rex. He ran off displaying it proudly and making loud roaring noises as he went. The second friend pulled the lever and got a temporary tattoo of a fire-breathing dragon. He grabbed his father and dragged him into the bathroom to immediately apply it to his arm with warm water from the sink. Finally, Hayden approached the machines and carefully chose where to place his quarters. He pushed and pulled, and out came a small plastic capsule with something inside. He handed it to me to pry the top off, and out came a small gold bracelet with heart charms. Disaster! I knew I had about a half a second to reframe this experience for my son, or there could be a legendary meltdown. After all, a heart bracelet is a devastating prize for a young boy when compared to a T-Rex and a fire-breathing dragon tattoo. I'm not always so quick on my feet in such circumstances, but this time, without any hesitation, I held it up, pointed to it, and emphatically yelled, "Pirate treasure!" He grabbed it from me and ran off clutching it, yelling, "Yeah!" at the top of his lungs. That is reframing. Sometimes the most important thing we do as teachers is to take subjects, which to a lot of our students start off as the equivalent of little heart bracelets, and by using passion, enthusiasm, powerful presentations, and creativity, turn it into pirate treasure. The entire Teach Like a Pirate system is tailor-made to help make that transformation possible. Enthusiasm. Nothing great was ever achieved without enthusiasm. Ralph Waldo Emerson. There is nothing more contagious on this planet than enthusiasm. The songs become incidental. What people receive is your joy. Carlos Santana. If the body leads, the brain will follow. Dave Burgess. It's no accident that the cornerstones of the Teach Like a Pirate system are passion and enthusiasm. I believe excellence as a teacher starts with having passion for what you do in life and is driven home with your enthusiasm. Enthusiasm is the closer that comes into the game in the ninth inning and finishes it off. If you apply nothing else from this book, but you consistently ramp up your enthusiasm level in the classroom, you will be far ahead of the game and a dramatically better teacher. Enthusiasm is that important. Even on the days when some students may not be enthralled with the subject matter, they are engaged by, if nothing else, the fact that I am wound up and going off. The ability to perceive the ebb and flow of the engagement in the classroom and then counter with an adjustment and enthusiasm is a skill that is almost impossible to quantify and tough to teach. It's a skill that separates good teachers from great ones. I'll always choose a teacher with enthusiasm and weak technique over one with brilliant strategies, but who is just punching the clock. Why? An enthusiastic teacher can learn technique, method, and strategy, but it is almost impossible to light a fire inside the charred heart of a burned-out teacher. The commitment to being on. Confession time. As an educator, there are a lot of things I'm not good at. I don't always grade promptly or provide quick and meaningful feedback to my students. I tend to let papers and projects pile up, which means I eventually tackle them without the same attention to detail I would have if I had graded more consistently. I'm not good at organizing and implementing long-term group projects. When my students work collaboratively, I'm not great at parsing out credit in a way that is fair to everybody. I haven't figured out the perfect system to deal with those situations when one or two students do the majority of the work and some are freeloaders. I'm still working out how to teach my students to take meaningful notes. I could get a lot better at incorporating technology in my classroom, especially in the hands of my students. My list of inadequacies in the classroom could go on and on to such embarrassing lengths that you would begin to wonder why I could have possibly thought myself worthy of writing a book on teaching. 17 years into the game, and I'm still a work in progress. Despite all my shortcomings, I know I excel in one important area. Enthusiasm. I pride myself on flat out bringing it, whether I'm teaching a class of students or leading a seminar for teachers. I'm absolutely committed to being on every period of the day. If you walk into my room during first period and then come back for sixth period at the end of the day, you will see the same intensity in my presentation both times. I pride myself on that almost more than anything else I do. In part, I think my ability to be on is a byproduct of my experience as a magician. Most magicians, and I'm no exception, get their first paid gigs as children's performers at birthday parties. I have the utmost respect for magicians who effectively work this market. It is tough work. Performers who are weak or lack audience engagement skills get eaten alive. Sounds like teaching, doesn't it? The gig is sort of like being a permanent substitute teacher, one of the toughest assignments in the educational world. To top it off, almost all the shows are on Saturdays and Sundays, and a busy performer might have 4 or 5 shows a day. By the 4th or 5th show, it would be easy to just go through the motions as you perform the same tricks all over again. But as a professional, you can't. If for no other reason, you know, someone is standing in the back of the room with her checkbook in hand. She's the mother. You are being paid for this performance. She could care less that her child's party is your 5th of the day. This is the only 6th birthday party her child will ever have. It's the only time many people in the crowd will actually see a professional magician perform live right in front of them. They will judge whether magic is an art form worthy of paid performance at other venues based in part on what you do in that moment. Professional performers feel a huge weight of responsibility to deliver something special for this particular audience on this particular day. What you've done before in your day or your career doesn't matter a bit. You have to bring it now. Teaching is exactly like that. I might be the only person who ever talks to my students about Malcolm X in their whole life. I refuse to cheat a student by delivering a subpar performance just because he has me later in the day or early in the day when I'm not quite awake. Although no mother stands in the back of the room with a checkbook, in a very real sense, I know 40 mothers in a whole community are counting on me. That's why, if you are my student or you come to my workshop, I personally guarantee I won't cheat you in the enthusiasm department. Even if you're the only person in the room, I'm going to flat out bring it. It isn't easy for anyone to be on every time they're in front of an audience. Les Brown shares a story in his The Power of Purpose audio program about getting a late night call from a young man who had come to hear him speak and felt Les hadn't given his best. Les offered all kinds of excuses, complaints about the circumstances surrounding the event, unfulfilled promises of the promoters, the small crowd size, but the kid wouldn't let him off the hook. Finally, Les relented when the kid threw his own line back in his face. "You said we must deal with circumstances such as we find them." I've never forgotten that story, and I have vowed that although I will do my best to create ideal circumstances, I will not allow that which is outside my control to affect my effort and enthusiasm. I have walked into some amazingly challenging scenarios as I've traveled around giving professional development workshops and keynotes. I never know what I'll find. I once presented in a converted hotel room with 70-plus people packed in everywhere, including sitting on the floor directly behind me. My colleague Ruben Hoffman was in the hall packing more and more in. We broke a lot of fire codes that day. On the other hand, I have presented to tiny groups spread out over huge gymnasiums. Neither situation is ideal, but I repeat Les's line in my mind, "You must deal with circumstances such as you find them." My job is to put myself in a powerful state and to do my best to rock the house. Two ways to light your fire. It's not good enough for me to just tell you why it's so important to be enthusiastic and leave out the how. The single most important thing I've learned from Anthony Robbins is the importance of questions. Many of my methods for improving creativity have been inspired by his work in this area. The second most important thing I learned from Anthony Robbins is how to control and change your state. In Unlimited Power, he provides great insight into how to almost instantly change your mental and emotional state. I took his instruction and tweaked and adapted it into something that has helped my teaching immensely. The first step to changing your state uses the act as if principle. Here's a big secret to enthusiasm that seems so ridiculous you might be tempted to reject it. Unlike passion, enthusiasm can be faked. Faking enthusiasm is so easy I can sum it up in two words. Act enthusiastic. Even if you are only acting at first, an amazing thing happens along the way. You actually start to really feel and become enthusiastic because of your breath pattern and the way you're holding and moving your body. Do you want to feel powerful? Move your body and breathe in a powerful way. Do you want to be more confident when you're speaking in public? Think about how a confident person moves, sounds, and acts. Do that. Anthony Robbins said, acting as if is most effective when you put your physiology in the state you'd be in if you were already effective. There is some truth to the often disparaged expression, fake it until you make it. You can instantly change your state by changing your physiology. Robbins explains the change like this. If you adopt a vital, dynamic, excited physiology, you automatically adopt the same kind of state. The biggest leverage we have in any situation is physiology because it works so fast and it works without fail. I have a ritual for starting class that puts me in the proper state to be effective, discussed in the rapport chapter. It includes multiple elements of my physiology, including posture, breathing, tonality, and movement. It's my way of ensuring I am in my most powerful state when I present for my class. Welcome to class. Thank you for coming. My name's Dave Burgess, and I'll be your host on this learning extravaganza. This expression anchors me to the state I want to be in. Sometimes before seminars, for example, I use internal dialogue to ready myself to present in a powerful way. I also use music as an anchor. When I hear the pirate music playing in my seminar room, it puts me in a place to be ready to dominate. The combination of the music, my internal dialogue, and my changes in body posture and breathing makes me feel absolutely unstoppable. The second way to change your state is to change what you focus on. You know the feeling of being completely exhausted when it's all you can do to pry your eyes open and to try to keep from nodding off for increasingly longer periods of time? What happens when you remember something critically important that you forgot to do, or the phone rings and someone delivers exciting news? Doesn't your state change within seconds? Suddenly you can't even imagine going to sleep. It would be completely impossible to sleep now because your mind is focused on this new information. That's amazing. You can go from one polar extreme to the other with nothing more than a thought. As a teacher, your days comprise enough positive and negative experiences to either make you feel energized and amazing or beat down and depressed. What you choose to attend to creates your reality. Some teachers look out over a 99% engaged classroom with kids on fire about learning and feel successful. Others choose to focus on that 1% and feel like failures. Make a conscious decision to focus on what empowers you. I know I simply can't be my most powerful and effective self if I'm not in the right state, so I carefully manage my thoughts to the best of my ability. You wouldn't put trash and destructive chemicals into your car's gas tank. So don't choose to focus on negative and destructive thoughts with your brain. Managing your state is way more important than managing your car, and yet people allow themselves to be dragged down into the muck of negativity. This job is tough enough without having to fight through self-imposed negativity. You'll face plenty of real dragons as an educator. Don't create new ones. When you find yourself in a state that feels less than resourceful, use these two highly effective ways to create a change. Either change your physiology and begin moving in a more powerful and resourceful way, or change the focus of your attention. I highly recommend reviewing the Professional Passion section of the Passion Chapter to get some great ideas for what to focus on so you can create a more resourceful and enthusiastic state. Spread the virus. By lighting yourself on fire with enthusiasm, you could become a beacon of bliss amidst a bastion of boredom and banality. Your attitude carries with it your single most powerful tool to influence your classroom. Carlos Santana said, "There's nothing more contagious on this planet than enthusiasm. The songs become incidental. What people receive is your joy." As a teacher, I would tweak this to the lessons become incidental. What people receive is your joy. It doesn't particularly matter what the subject is. Our mission is to teach in such a way that who we are as human beings has a more powerful and lasting effect on our students than what we say. When we model enthusiasm, it rubs off on everybody around us. It is absolutely contagious. Be sure to spread it liberally every day, because I guarantee that your students have many people in their lives who are trying to kill their enthusiasm and dampen their spirits. Infect your lessons and everything you do with enthusiasm, and then watch it spread. Part 2. Crafting Engaging Lessons. The Third Circle. A good teacher, like a good entertainer, first must hold his audience's attention. Then he can teach his lesson. Hendrick John Clark. The power of a lesson cannot be maximized without incorporating a masterful presentation. It's like riding a bike with flat tires. You may be doing everything right, but you're working harder than necessary and getting subpar results. When you have crafted an engaging lesson for your material, it's like coasting downhill on a perfectly tuned bicycle with two fully inflated tires. Everything seems easier because the students are drawn into your material as if by some magical or magnetic force. The Teach Like a Pirate system I presented in Section 1 lays the foundation for building these magical and magnetic results. All 6 of those chapters are critically important to effectively reaching and teaching your students. This section focuses on the how of creating engaging lessons. It is a toolbox of strategies you can draw on to energize your lessons and engage your students. After all, it's one thing to know you should engage your students. Actually, being engaging requires planning, preparation, and presentation. Picture a triple Venn diagram. The overwhelming majority of professional development workshops focus on the bottom two circles, content and technique and method. Without question, these areas are critical. If you don't have the content element of your lesson in place, you are either just entertaining or babysitting. My assumption is that you are an expert in your subject's content. If not, put this book down and go learn your subject. Come back when you're ready to present a lesson. I'm also making the assumption in this discussion that through your educational program and professional development, you have an array of instructional techniques and methods at your disposal. I'm sure you've been to the Think, Pair, Share workshop and the Jigsaw session. You probably learned about scaffolding and SDI strategies, attended the literacy training to learn how to build academic vocabulary, and you probably already know the benefits of graphic organizers. Those are all good tools and techniques. The third circle, presentation, is the critical element most professional development seminars and training materials miss. Nobody is talking to teachers about the third circle, and I'm trying to change that forever. I'm on a one-man mission, traveling far and wide to spread the word about the existence and importance of presentation. I have an evangelical zeal for this message. Welcome to the barbecue. If you come to my house for a dinner and you see me out at the barbecue, you have every reason to be excited. You can expect to get a well-prepared and delicious meal. But imagine your surprise if we sat down at the table and I presented you with a plate that was empty with the exception of a completely raw steak. This will be wildly inappropriate. If I were really going to serve you dinner, I'd ask ahead of time if you even like steak. If you don't, I would provide alternatives. If you do like steak, I would season and marinate the meat ahead of time to allow the flavors to soak in. I would preheat the barbecue by turning on the propane. Sorry, I know I just lost you coal-only fanatics. And then baste it and turn it until cooked to your specifications. Even after that, I still just wouldn't serve it to you without providing various side dishes and a beverage to help wash it down. After finishing, I would let you indulge your sweet tooth by providing a scrumptious dessert. That's a meal. Obviously, we can't serve people raw steak on a plate. However, that's exactly what some educators serve their students every day. Teachers like this walk into class with their raw, unseasoned content, plop it down in front of their kids and say, "Eat it!" They don't bother to provide a side dish, and a dessert is way too much trouble. No wonder their students act as if learning is a form of torture that must be endured as they choke down their lessons. The presentational strategies described in this book that are designed to hook your students and draw them into your lesson are like the seasoning and marinade. You have to prepare these elements ahead of time. You can't just walk into class with a raw, unseasoned steak. After you've carefully seasoned your lesson and soaked it in student engagement sauce, you still have to cook it. I don't put my steak down on a coal grill. I preheat it. When you drop your steak on a coal grill, nothing happens. When you drop your steak on a preheated grill, it sizzles. I want my content to sizzle when I drop it. You can do this by creating mystery, curiosity, anticipation, and buzz. You have to turn up the heat. In other words, you have to bring energy to your lesson through enthusiasm and showmanship. You have to sell it. You also can't just do it at the beginning of the lesson either. For best results, the heat and energy must be maintained. Just like meat has to be turned and basted, you have to continually add engaging twists, turns, and changes of pace throughout the lesson. You must layer your hooks so that engagement doesn't wane. 40 minutes into your class, you can't say, "Hey, don't you remember that funny thing I said 40 minutes ago? You should still be paying attention." No, layer in as many engaging strategies and techniques as you can possibly fit. I take that back. Layer in those techniques and strategies until it's unreasonable, then scale back later if you have to. As for the side dishes and dessert, those are the parts of the lesson only the uptight and misguided view as a waste of time. There is no award given to the teacher who fills every class period with bell-to-bell direct instruction. It doesn't matter how much material you teach. It only matters how much is received. By adding in the type of presentational elements featured in this part of the book, you will not be wasting precious instructional minutes. Rather, you'll be creating a dynamic and well-rounded lesson that is highly engaging, easily memorable, and powerfully impactful. In addition, no content standard in any class at any level is more important than nurturing and building a love of learning. Designing a class that empowers students to become lifelong learners, avid readers, and voracious seekers of knowledge will have an impact that reverberates for a lifetime and beyond. The point of this section is to help you build presentations in such a way that students will actually want to come to school. When you use the Teach Like a Pirate system and effectively present your material, students will realize education can be fun, entertaining, amazing, and at the same time, life-changing. Everything is a choice. Designing lessons is a task filled with an overwhelming number of presentational choices. Everything you do or don't do is a choice. In some of my workshops, I perform a mental magic effect with a freely called number from the audience. The whole routine takes about 4 minutes from start to finish, and it's usually met with spontaneous applause. In fact, if it isn't met with applause, then I did it wrong. Here's the clincher. The whole trick is math. That's right. I perform math in front of the crowd and receive applause. In fact, when I get hired to do a magic show, this piece is almost always in my set. Math as a performance art. I get paid to do math. How is that possible? Presentation. After the performance, I go back to the start and show my workshop participants all of the presentational decisions that are a part of those 4 minutes. There are about 10 major presentational decisions, choices, that combine to make an entertaining and effective routine. If there are 10 decisions in a 4-minute routine, do the math and figure out how many presentational choices there are in an hour-long lesson. Some choices are major and others are minor, but even the minor decisions, when added up, create impact. Are the lights on when students enter the room? Is there music playing? And if so, what? Is there anything written on the board to draw students' attention? Have the desks been rearranged? Do I pass out the handout right away or wait? What do I wear to class to present this lesson? And those are just the presentational decisions that make an impact on a class before the bell rings. Some of you may be thinking, I don't make decisions about all of those things for each lesson. Actually, you do. If there's no music playing when students enter your class, it's because you didn't put any on. If you gave no thought to the matter, then what's really going on is that you have abdicated responsibility for that decision. By not consciously controlling the vast array of presentational factors at your disposal, you have diminished your professional power and dampened the potential impact of your lesson. I know each individual decision by itself doesn't seem to matter. The problem, though, is that none of these individual decisions stands alone. Rather, they are woven together into what can be made a beautiful quilt of engagement or an ugly threadbare blanket of boredom, determined to intentionally control your environment and all of the presentational elements in play. Everything matters. Transitions will kill you. One of the ways to tell the difference between a professional magician and an amateur is how they transition from one trick to another. The amateur strings together a series of unrelated or loosely related tricks with awkward pauses and transitions. He does one thing, puts it away, then searches for the next prop or tries to think about what he will do next. The pro has a theme that ties his series effects into an act. One trick naturally flows into another with no awkward pauses or confusion about where he's going next. A professional makes you feel comfortable as an audience because the long, hard work of eliminating awkward moments has created a unifying and congruent experience. Teaching is exactly the same. After reading this book and practicing the principles, you will have an incredible array of tools to actively engage your class. Don't go to all the effort to design an amazing and engaging hook for your content, only to squander the moment with an ill-timed transition. Your key content, the most important information you're trying to teach, should be delivered at the moment of peak engagement. Far too many times, teachers capture the attention and engagement of their class and then lose it by adding some unnecessary delay between the hook and the delivery of the content. For example, they tell a powerful story that has the class in the palm of their hand. Then, upon finishing the story, they have the students get a piece of paper out of their notebook before tying it all together with their lesson. They knew that paper was going to be needed, so they should have told the students to get it out before starting the damn story. Every time you allow or add an unnecessary delay in your presentation, you create another time that you'll have to regain the engagement and momentum you lost. Those 2 minutes spent queuing up the video clip matter. Something as simple as waiting for the projector to warm up can be responsible for losing a portion of your audience. It's not that I'm overly concerned about lost minutes. Engagement is the real loss. Every time I lose my students' focus to an unnecessary delay is another time I must go to the hard work of hooking them yet again. It's like a street performer who earns a living by entertaining passers-by for tips. The hardest thing to do as a street performer is to build an audience. Therefore, once the audience has been built, it is imperative to avoid a break in the performance that would cause people to lose interest and leave. To keep your students from mentally checking out, try to get all of your administrative activities out of the way before beginning your presentation. If the students will need any materials, their books, papers, pens, etc., have them get them out before you start. When you are forced to have a transition, try to make it as quick and seamless as possible. The projector should be warming up while you're giving the high-interest introduction to the video clip. When someone comes into my room with a pass or to take someone out of class, I will either, based on the situation, continue to present my material, or I will banter and interact in an entertaining way with the person who has entered the room so that I maintain engagement. My goal is to avoid coming to a dead stop and losing my audience as a result. That's why, unlike many teachers, I never really get upset at interruptions, but choose to position them as more of a game and a challenge. Eliminating and smoothing out transitions may seem like such a small thing to harp on, but the results can be significant. There is a magical moment I love to create in my classroom. Sometimes it is verbally expressed. Other times I can just see it in my students' body language. It's the moment following a highly engaging hook, one that often fills the room with fun and laughter, and all of a sudden they realize, hey, he's teaching us. It's as if they are having such a great time and so engrossed in the moment that they forget where they are and when it dawns on them that they're learning. I picture the toughest and hardest-headed students saying, dang it, I wasn't going to learn today. He tricked me. That man is sneaky. I live for that moment. When I model these techniques in my workshops, I ask the teachers to see if they can find the point at which that moment would happen for a student. Once I teach the concept, most participants can easily and correctly identify it. More importantly, they learn how to design their presentation to include those magical moments. I encourage you to not only master the art of gaining student engagement, but also the art of not losing it. A crash course in presentational hooks. Do not repeat the means of victory, but respond to form from the inexhaustible. Sun Tzu. This is where the rubber meets the road. In this chapter, you'll find one presentational hook after another. If you have ever seen the full-day version of my Teach Like a Pirate seminar, then you know that it's roughly divided into three sections: the Teach Like a Pirate system, the modeling and explanations of multiple presentational hooks, and the collaborative brainstorming session using my Power Pack creativity questions. This chapter is a partial combination of the hooks and the creativity questions. It is filled with an unbelievable variety of ideas for drawing students into your content, and it also relies heavily on questions that will help you devise ways to incorporate these ideas into your own lessons. If you will take the time to actively consider these questions and intentionally seek ways that they might apply to your class, I think you will be richly rewarded. When I first decided to get into the professional development business, my number one concern was whether or not I could translate what I do into something that is both teachable and transferable to other educators. Sure, my methods are successful for me, but can I make them accessible to others? Or do they work because of who I am as a person? Today, I am thoroughly convinced that any teacher who is willing to put in the time, care, and effort can transform their classroom and their life as an educator using these methods. Much of your success as an educator has to do with your attitude towards teaching and towards kids. The rest of your success is based on your willingness to relentlessly search for what engages students in the classroom and then having the guts to do it. When writing this section of my material, I evaluated the presentational hooks I use in my classes and asked myself, how did I come up with that? Over and over again, the answer was that I asked myself a series of specific types of questions. This chapter includes those exact types of questions. I believe they can lead you to your own creative insights if you will actively and intentionally use them. Because I teach history, many of the examples are history-related. Don't be put off by that. The questions and the techniques here are the important factors, not the subject focus. It's not unlike teaching someone to play guitar. First, a student must learn how to hold the instrument, where to put his fingers, and how to strum. Next, he learns basic chord structures. Then and only then does the student choose an area of focus: classical, jazz, rock and roll. Everyone must learn the basic chords first. This section is teaching chord structure. You will go off and play English, math, science, primary, secondary, and so on. The chord structure remains the same. I encourage you to use this section of the book as a resource. Return to it anytime you need a creative boost for your lessons. I don't know if you have ever seen the MTV show Pimp My Ride, but this is the section that will allow you to take run-of-the-mill lessons and pimp them for a certain wow factor. You can work your way through these questions with a particular lesson or unit in mind, or you can just consider your curriculum as a whole and see what sparks a creative idea. I also recommend that you work collaboratively through this section of the book. Find a colleague with whom you can brainstorm ideas. And if your first experiences with this brainstorming process are less than you desired, keep at it. The more you engage in these activities, the better you'll get. With practice, you will train your brain to think more creatively. Remember, asking the right questions gives your subconscious mind's search engine a goal. Don't be surprised to find that your best answers come to you well after you've put this book away and have engaged in a completely unrelated activity. When you are engaged in intense creative work, sometimes it isn't until you've let your brain relax and move on that insights occur. I recommend that you have something to write your ideas on as you proceed so that you don't lose them forever. One final word of instruction for using this section. Don't take it too seriously. Be willing to have fun with the process. These questions are in no way meant to be all-inclusive. Feel free to generate your own questions that may better reflect your teaching style. I simply offer these as a starting point, as an example of how to become actively engaged in the creative process rather than waiting for that infamous flash of inspiration. Let's get it on. I like to move it. Hooks containing an element of movement can be extremely effective. The brain and body work best when receiving the flow of oxygen and blood. That doesn't happen when students spend their days sitting at a desk. If your class is stagnant and energy has reached a low point, it may be time to incorporate more kinesthetic activities. The kinesthetic hook. How can I incorporate movement into this lesson? Can we throw something, roll something, or catch something inside or outside of class? Can we get up and act something out? Can we incorporate gestures and motions that students could do from their desks? Can we turn the room into a giant opinion meter and have students move to one side or the other based on the statement? What kind of simulation can we do that would allow them to reenact a part of this lesson? Can I change the structure of this lesson from a seated activity to a walk-around activity? Can I use a game that incorporates movement and action to enhance this lesson? How can I guarantee that every student is up and out of their desk at least once during this lesson? Examples. My students have collected moon rocks, practice golf balls, that I spread out all over a field behind my class. They have flown like Charles Lindbergh across the Atlantic, roped cattle, or a stool in this case, on a cattle drive, flown paper airplanes during the Berlin airlift lesson, boarded a Montgomery bus, played intense games of trench warfare on the floor behind desks, and fit into a box like Henry Box Brown did to mail himself to freedom. They have worked on assembly lines and competed in boot camp obstacle courses. They've even learned to juggle as part of a lesson on the three branches of government. I promise you will notice a significant increase in your room's energy when you incorporate movement into your lessons. It's okay to have fun. It's never a bad idea to inject some kinesthetic activity into your class, even if the primary goal is just to have some fun. Recently, I presented a lecture about the resistance to slavery and the unique way slaves sought freedom. After telling them the story of Henry Box Brown being mailed to freedom, I challenged my students to try to fit into a box that was smaller in every way than Henry's. We discussed the dimensions, and then I let them have at it. I used a large plastic storage bin, and they had to get in far enough for me to be able to close the lid. As the day went on, things got wilder and wilder. I mentioned to my third period that four students made it in second period, so they proceeded to fit 19 people in the box. 20 if you count the campus supervisor who came to deliver a pass and agreed to give it a try. The kids loved it. Fifth period took the challenge and got 22 students into the box. The peer pressure to try was intense, but all good-natured. By the time sixth period rolled in, many of the students had heard of the challenge. They stormed into class saying, "Where's the box?" I told them to hold on. They have to learn why there is a box in the first place before getting in it. They set the day's record by fitting 24 different students into the box during a class period. The next day, second period demanded a second chance and fit 31.